Hello, I'm Makita Oliver.
And I'm Desiree Birch. And this is Escape, the Underground Railroad podcast.
A collection of stories about the rebellions, escapes, and uprisings of our enslaved ancestors, served alongside the powerful and evocative Amazon Prime Video series, The Underground Railroad.
We're going to be exploring the strengths, struggles, and strategies of our super smart, inventive ancestors, the real life, formidable heroes through history who never back down in the face of brutality.
And we're starting with a story from the real life Underground Railroad. Question, how do 28 people disguise themselves for an escape in broad daylight through a busy city?
In a really big trench coat. Come on.
They just reached a point where they needed to make a move. They needed to escape. So it was just the right time, the right moment, but it was planned. It wasn't just a happenstance. As people say, they just didn't wake up one morning and say, we're gonna run. No, this was a planned escape of a group of 28 that had almost never happened before.
Okay, so before we get into our first story, I want to talk about Cora, Desiree.
Yes, yes. For those who may be unaware, Cora is the heroine of the new limited Amazon Prime series, The Underground Railroad, that we are going to be talking about always on this podcast.
And it's directed by Barry Jenkins, who, of course, directed Moonlight, which is just absolutely beautiful. And this is the same. And the story follows Cora's escape from enslavement on a Georgia plantation.
She escapes via the Underground Railroad, which historically was not an actual railroad, but in this show, it definitely is. Like, we're going to see her get on an underground system of trains to go to safe houses on safe routes.
Yeah, in this series, the Underground Railroad is literally a railway under the soil.
With some, like, beautiful, magical realism that really brings it to life. I mean, I would say that railroad shot, although completely fictional, was beautiful enough and intense enough to make me think, was there a real railroad? So right. They did that really, really well.
Oh, God. And the run, like that run when they run through the field, yep. Caesar and Cora, yeah. And they get and they're on their way to, you know, it doesn't even need to be a railroad. They're just running somewhere yeah. else. Finally. Yeah.
And like almost falling as they're running and just like having to break for a house and being like, literally, we've come this far and we could get killed in between here and the house. It's just so, like, I'll never forget that image.
And you know what? I feel like a lot of things, Desiree, in the episode, I was like, I don't think I'm going to forget this or this yeah. or this for a while. Like, it yeah. really sits with you. Not just, of course, the horror, but I think also the fortitude stays with you in this yeah. really, like, it gets in your bones. These yeah. are our people. And they were strong and powerful and showed that constantly.
Anyway, look, you just need to watch the series, like, right now.
Yeah. So there were many uprisings and rebellions, but they weren't written about or well documented at all. Historically and presently, these stories are just kept out of the curriculum and they're kept out of mainstream media, which just makes me want to ask the question to you, Desiree. How did you learn about these uprisings as a young girl? Because obviously over here in the UK, we just weren't taught anything. What did you know?
A bunch of white people did some really important things that saved the universe, and the black yeah. people sung some fucking songs. You know, the drill.
Standard shit.
I am trying to think of any time that we were taught about uprisings. We were obviously taught about the abolition movement because they could take great pains to point out very wonderful, noble, righteous white people who were involved in that. You definitely have to know about notable names like Harriet Tubman, obviously, is usually our one and only reference point for the Underground Railroad, through which they talk about, oh, it was a series, you know, network of people and houses and places and ways that you could travel ultimately to get to the north, but like, you know, better off in Canada. You rarely, if ever, hear about Black people as the leaders, the creators of their own resistance. It's like the same way that you hear about Rosa Parks being a tired old woman who just wanted to sit down and not someone who had a history of civil disobedience and who had planned this out to a T. So it's always sort of a happenstance kind of thing that they just lucked out that they met like a really smart white person.
Yeah, it's just this one-off moment that happened occasionally.
Yeah. What about here in the UK? Like, how were you taught about the slave trade or slavery in the US or in the Caribbean or wherever?
I mean, of course, we, you know, my grandparents are from Antigua, so we had knowledge of the Windrush. But I mean, the Windrush is so terribly celebrated. Just sort of the moment of it happening is only in the last 5 years, really sort of trying to have things that discuss it, things that actually celebrate us all coming here and integrating with British people. But it's not something that was even mentioned in education at all. And when it comes to US slavery, I would go as far as saying we know absolutely nothing unless we watched films or unless you had parents that would tell you about it. I think the probably Amistad is when I first started learning properly. Gotcha. So it took Steven Spielberg for me to learn anything before the whole British education system could tell us anything. So I think this is, you know, again, when I watched The Underground Railroad, I was sort of prepared for the horror, but mainly because of my imagination.
Yeah, no, it's astounding. I happened to be in a car with two other white comedians who I won't name on our way to a gig, and someone had been reading the paper when the Windrush scandal broke about how all of these people who were like desperately needed to come and work were promised citizenship, never given any paperwork, and then unceremoniously sent the hell home. One of the guys was reading the front cover. He was like, the Windrush, like, but he's like, what was that? And then both of them just sort of slowly looked over at me, and I was like, so you know it's a black thing. And you're expecting the only black person within like 100 feet, which is me, to explain to you what your own history is right now. So that to me was quite telling about the stories we tell ourselves about what is important to our stories and to our present.
But how slavery is taught here, if it is taught, is really passive. We were taken, we were forced on ships, we were made to work. Not going into the resistance that came with all that can actually do a lot of damage to your sense of self if this is the only way you're hearing about the people that you've descended from. It's so important to know and understand that resistance to slavery was relentless. And as long as there was slavery, there was resistance to it.
Yes.
Feels good to just say that, to be fair.
Yes, it feels good to say that. And it's going to feel so good to know that for people now and for their future generations to always know this was not something that was taken lying down. And in fact, people went to great lengths and odds to rescue themselves and each other. Stuff was popping off pretty much everywhere in America around that time. And that's what we're going to focus on in this show throughout the diaspora. So let's just get into it.
Let's just do it.
It's a balmy hot Sunday afternoon in Northern Kentucky in 1853. A light breeze moves through the trees as I lay out the chairs for this week's service. I'm pretty sure there'll be some resistance, but I know this is the right thing to do for us now and generations to come. So in my sermon today, I'm going to tell them, convince them, that we need to make a break for our freedom. All of us. Together.
So who is this and what's about to happen here, Desiree?
This is the story of Washington Parker of the Cincinnati 28 and the Underground Railroad.
So this one I've never heard of.
Yeah, not many people have. I've only recently learned of it myself, and it is a banging story. And we have got Dr. Eric Jackson down the line from Cincinnati, Ohio, to tell us more. Eric is professor of history at Northern Kentucky University. With almost 25 years of academic experience, he teaches in the fields of American and African American studies, race relations, and peace studies. He has over 50 publications in journals such as Africology, the Journal of Pan-African Studies, and the Journal of African American History. Dr. Eric Jackson, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much for being here. Is it okay if I call you Eric?
Yes, absolutely. The doctor tag is just reserved for my students and when I'm at university.
I quite like it, though. Dr. Eric
I
Jackson,
know.
Right?
And but Dr. Eric sounds like you're some kind of made-up wellness doctor, so I think it's either Dr. Jackson or Eric. So, Eric, who exactly was Washington Parker?
Washington Parker was a enslaved African-American in Boone County, Kentucky, which is right outside of Cincinnati on the other side of the Ohio River. He was one of the few enslaved African-Americans on this Boone County plantation that was in the city of Petersburg, Kentucky. So because enslavement was not a cash crop-driven society in Northern Kentucky, he served as a person who was in the house most time serving the owner. So he was taught how to read and write as a youngster. The power that he possessed is in that skill of reading and writing, that he interpreted the scriptures in a way that was different than whites, that he took the scriptures and turned it into what scholars call later black or liberation theology, that argues that you use this type of theology to empower yourself and your community. So for him, the type of Christianity that he was talking about on that particular day in April of 1853 was a different brand of Christianity that empowered folks. And for him, his freedom came with understanding that even the Christians in that region were using a brand of Christianity that was draining the life out of people of color by justifying their bondage to the larger society.
I wasn't aware of that, and that just feels like a whole new, I don't know, dark level to use religion in that way.
Yeah. The only thing that you could learn about was Christianity, and it was mostly about the, you know, all of the suffer little children, all of your rewards will be in heaven, but not now, you know.
I agree.
What would have been the main things that just took them to the place of making the break for freedom and not just discussing it? You know, well, you know, this is essentially a life and death decision.
What took them to that place was the continued abuse they were taking, that their allegations that the group that was on that plantation, which again is not necessarily those images of plantations you might think about in the deep south of the United States that's growing cotton or tobacco or rice in South Carolina. What you have going on is in Northern Kentucky is this type of enslavement where folks are horribly treated. The abuse is there. It's just not driven by a cash crop. So they had reached a point on that particular day, at that particular time, in that particular instance, that they just had enough, that the time was right, that the situation was right, the attitudes was right. White owners were doing something else because they concocted this plan most times on Sundays when they didn't know that this new brand of Christianity was empowering folks. So they just reached a point where they needed to make a move. They needed to escape. They needed to move their psyches and their physical being to a different spot. So it was just the right time, the right moment, but it was planned. It wasn't just a happenstance. As people say, they just didn't wake up one morning and say, we're going to run. No, this was a planned escape of a group of 28 that had almost never happened before.
That's the information that we're given, is that these are just sort of one-off moments where it's sort of in a moment of madness. They said, let's get out of here. But people had to be ingenious and smart, you know, because of what risks they were taking with not just themselves, but the people around them. So I think that that's very convenient that, again, that's another part that's just been taken out of the history, the way people's minds worked, you know?
Yeah.
So, Eric, whose idea, I know there's a lot, you know, we're talking about 28 people that got out of this hellhole. Whose idea would it have been initially to make the break? Who would have been sort of leading the charge?
It's mostly Washington Parker, but it's other folks involved. Remember, you have to keep in mind, as you were talking earlier, that you had a system of enslavement where one of the justifications for enslaving people of African descent is to rationalize that they are not capable of thinking in their own space, that they're not capable of understanding and reasoning, that they're not capable of having these planned out activities, that the justification, even from a scripture standpoint, was to justify from a Christian standpoint that these folks were less than human, and psychologically, emotionally, they didn't have the capacity to actually plan this stuff out. And so some of this agitation of not understanding how the Underground Railroad and Washington Parker and all of the 27 other people is they had the capacity to learn. They had the capacity to reason. They had the capacity to understand that oppression was trying to define their humanity, destroy their souls.
I'm curious, with Washington Parker's congregation, they're in Northern Kentucky. Where are they escaping to? Or where at least are they escaping to first? What's the plan?
So the plan originally was to just cross the Ohio River, which divides Kentucky, Ohio, and Indiana, or as enslaved people called it at the time, the River Jordan, because they looked at things from a spiritual perspective. So the River Jordan is part of a story from the Bible that when you're being baptized in the water, where you submerge your worldly self into the river, and when you come up, you're a new person. So all the things you did in your former life was taken away, and you had this new life as a person. And so the Ohio River, in their minds, was a symbolism of being dunked in that water and then coming up on the other side as a new person. And that newness was freedom, even if the reality wasn't true per se. And I'll get to that in a minute. So you had to reach that river as quickly, as judiciously, systematically as possible. You had to reach the river because that river was your ticket to freedom. They're trying to get to Ohio. Ohio was a, quote, free state created in 1803, didn't legally enslave people. So they crossed that river. They got to reach Ohio by whatever means is necessary.
And what are their lives going to be like on the other side of the River Jordan? Like, what can they expect to change for them realistically in the free state of Ohio, just on the other side of a river?
Wow, that's a powerful question, and it's a complicated question because Ohio is created in 1803. The next year, in 1804, they institute what are called Black Codes. And the Black Codes are a series of codes that will institute a policy that says any person of color who comes to the state of Ohio must pay the state and the county a security deposit of $500 to come to our state.
But who's got, no one's got that kind of money.
So freedom is not really freedom. Freedom is what you can make out of somebody not owning you or your family.
We're still going to monetize your black bodies, just in a new way.
Also at the same time, there's people of color who are already there who had run away, who were born there. There's little pockets of community. One is called Bucktown and one is called Little Africa in Cincinnati. So there's a black communities already there waiting for them. Say, we will help you. We will help you when your escape attempts.
So that is kind of like any immigration story of like, there are pockets of us that exist. If we can make it there, we can build a life.
Correct.
So how would Washington have heard about the Underground Railroad?
Oral history is the key. Most people of color have traced their histories just in general terms that are passed down through families orally. So there was always these stories of this Underground Railroad that had been created. Some of it was out of mythology intentionally so those slave catchers couldn't catch folks or people couldn't recapture folks, but some of it was real. Meaning that, for example, the first time the term Underground Railroad develops is in 1831. This guy named Tice David escapes from Kentucky to Ohio, and his owner states in 1831, this person must have disappeared using an underground road. And so the term sticks, Underground Railroad, because as the term is being talked about by him and his family and the community, the railroad system itself is being built in the United States. So the term becomes synonymous with an actual road. The mythology is that these poor people of color somehow connected with these progressive whites, and they're so good-hearted that they help them free themselves, and everybody's nice, and everybody's singing these kumbaya songs. The reality is most of the Underground Railroad is organized by other black people. Black people helping other black people. And it happens to be a few whites sprinkled around. And it's like when you talk about history, the power of history, in my opinion, and throughout my educational career, is the power is in the story, but the control is who writes the story. Because if white people are writing the story, they becomes the heroes and the sheroes.
Got it.
It's not the black people. It's not the oppressed people.
So almost every time we see a white person in an Underground Railroad story, we should be like, that's probably been miscast. Unless they're like someone by name that we know.
It's a supporting cast. They're not the main actors. They're the supporting.
Got it.
That makes sense.
There's the sassy white friend. Cool. All right. Washington Parker and his congregation have made the decision they are going to escape. What are they bringing with them? What is important for them to have on this journey ahead? What are they packing? What are they leaving behind?
Clothes, maps, a few names of folks they could trust once they reach the other side of the river. They couldn't take anything that would make noise. Most of their food they would take had to be eaten quickly because it would turn bad. Eaten off the land would be berries, leaves. Sometimes today they would be called greens. They would eat frogs. They would eat fish. Even in some cases, they were insects they would eat. Nothing I would eat, but whatever.
And this is my question, Eric. There's 28 people of all different ages on this journey. How long were they thinking this was going to take them? How long was this whole group going to be traveling across a part of America together?
They didn't know. They were expecting anywhere between a couple days to a week.
Okay.
So they didn't know exactly how long it would take them.
And you say they got carriages, horses. These are things that would have been picked up on the way by trusted people that they knew that they could meet and get these things from. So this takes so much planning.
Which again flies in the face of those folks who were justifying the enslavement of people of African descent. Did they just magically become smart? Did they just magically all of a sudden understand how to plan to run away?
Jesus did it. That's why they should never let them read the Bible.
They should have learned, shouldn't they? We've seen this done before. Mm-hmm. So, Eric, who was in this group that traveled with him? It's a pretty audacious move going in such a large group, right?
Well, so aside from Washington Parker, nobody really knows their names. I thought I had the names, but I went back to my resources. No names were used aside from Washington Parker in descriptions, aside from 28 people. All the descriptive terms placed on Washington Parker as the leader. You had descriptive terms that people who went with Washington Parker, some were in their 50s, and one toddler went. One baby came.
Wow. So a whole breadth of ages and abilities.
Yeah.
Dogs bark aggressively. Slave catchers shout instructions. Feet move at pace through the long grass. Our breathing is labored as we try to move as quietly as possible. At some point, we're going to have to lay down for the night. We're not close enough to any of the safe houses, so we'll be sleeping under the stars again tonight. This is something that you really can feel, the breathing and the stillness sort of just hype up the anxiety and the terror that is just constantly felt at all stages. Tell us what it would have been like, the atmosphere at this moment, being pursued, actually pursued by hunters with dogs and guns.
Terrifying. It's terrifying because you have to place the 28 in the contents of what's going on at the time in the United States. So they escape in April of 1853. In 1850, the United States passes what's called the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. And among other things, one of the key components of this act was that an owner could deputize anybody he wanted to recapture his fugitives. And if you refused to help him, you could be jailed yourself, You could be fined. You can even be killed. And so folks had to figure out what your course of action would be from being deputized. I'm putting this into context because those folks who were going to recapture fugitives like the Cincinnati 28 had more on their mind than just a day in walk in the park. They had their own livelihoods depending on following these orders. So they would chase people harder. They would use more violence. They would use more cunning skills. They would use more activities that they didn't use before. They would talk to their neighbors more. They were there, if not to recapture fugitives, they were out there to kill fugitives. So the violence level in the 1850s escalated to a point that it hadn't been that way in previous decades. So it was terrifying for those folks running away because they were under more scrutiny, under more pressure, under more psychological hardships just to reach that Ohio River because they knew the alternative in their minds could be just death, not like it wasn't before, but it was just ratcheted up to a different level because of the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850.
And once they reached the Ohio River, how did they get across?
So again, it wasn't just a spur of the moment. They planned that they had a piece of a wood, like a pole to stick in the water to move slowly across the river. Because when you stick a pole in the water and move it, it doesn't make noise. Compared if you're using a paddle will make a lot of noise because you're splashing water. A pole you stick in the ground and you move very slowly across the river because you're not making noise.
Yeah, that is like a whole new level of having to really be thoughtful about, you know, like to plan every single thing about escape, to know that paddles might give you away and you could get shot right in the middle of the river just as you're about to make it to the other side. To stick a pole in the ground is the safest way to do it. It's so genius.
It also slowed down your journey because poles take time to stick in the ground. A paddle, you can go a little faster. Not that they had speed was on their mind, but in a way, speed was on their mind because they had to get across the river as quickly as possible.
But it's speed versus detection, you know, like you've got to pick and choose which one is working for you. Yeah.
And with 28 people to organize to get there at one time, it's like, come on, come on.
Eric, there are 28 of them. Did they all make it?
No. One was a toddler and she passed away on the trip before they even got to the river.
Do we know how? Do we know what happened?
Malnutrition.
Yeah.
It's a lot trying to, 28 people trying to feed themselves throughout the days in silence being hunted.
Yeah, and to feed yourself well enough to then be have your body be able to feed a baby as well.
Feed a baby.
So 27 of them eventually make it to Ohio. Are they now safe? Are they free?
Free from being in an enslavement position? Yes. Free from being re-enslaved? No. Freedom to their destiny of where they want to go? No. Uh-huh. Because remember, this whole African-American environment is throughout the state of Ohio with that 1804 Black Codes. So they're trying to travel north. North meaning north part of the city, north part of the state of Ohio, north as far as they can go.
Got it.
So they have discovered that one of the ways they could navigate this freedom is to reposition themselves as in a non-threatening situation.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, just because they're in Cincinnati doesn't necessarily mean anything because Ohio, especially this area, is very divided about slaves and whether or not slaves should even be free still, which kind of feels very familiar to Britain post-Brexit. There's still a lot of internal divisions about who should be what and what the status of people would be.
Correct. Because Cincinnati is on the one hand, as historians have uncovered decades and centuries later, 50 to 60% of those folks who escaped from the south to the north using the Underground Railroad came through Cincinnati. Mm. So they're being welcomed undercover for some reason, but at the same time, they're being attacked because of the divisive nature of having fugitives in the city, in the cities, probably one of the most northern cities with a southern mentality from a geographical perspective in the United States.
Yeah.
And so they continue that journey and they understand that they're going to go through trials and tribulation, which is not new for people of color, even today.
Yeah.
So, Eric, arriving on the other side of the river is kind of the next stop on the Underground Railroad for everyone in this group. But someone's got to be there to meet them, to sort of lead them to a semblance of safety.
So you have a number of African-Americans who are part of the Underground Railroad who live in Cincinnati. Hatfield is biracial. He was a barber and he knew both the communities in the Bucktown and the Little Africa community. People just went to him from both communities for not only getting their hair cut, but to understand how the community functioned and who you could get a job from, who was paying the most money when you got a job, who would treat you fairly, and most importantly, who was involved in the Underground Railroad activities.
I just particularly love the fact that, like, all of these stories are being told from his seat. You know, I mean, there's something about the history of barbershops and beauty shops being these locales of, like, these community centers where information and things happen, where it's like a like the heartbeat of a community. And the fact that he was there cutting hair for whoever and being this sort of like, you know, crossing over point of like, oh, yeah, I'm the guy. Oh, yeah, I know a guy. Like, well, I'll hook you up in more ways than one is kind of fantastic.
Also, if you want to know what's going on in a town, like be in the hairdresser.
Yep.
Oh, sure. Right. Even today.
Yeah, to this day.
That's where I go.
So would you mind telling us about some of the sassy white friends of the Underground Railroad? Who were some of the white people that were part of the Underground Railroad? Just to
Let's talk about the supporting cast.
Yeah. Best supporting actresses and actors.
Of the Underground Railroad. The white folk.
Sassy white
friends. Well, it's time to reverse that trope.
Finally.
You don't know where they come from or where they go. They have no backstory. They're just here to help.
One of the famous families of sassy white people was the Beecher family from Harriet Beecher Stowe. Harriet Beecher Stowe writes Uncle Tom's Cabin, obviously, that becomes probably in a lot of literary arenas the first book that sells over 100,000 copies. Mm. On the institution of enslavement. Wow. Then there's a family called the Van Zant family. For a couple years, Levi Coffin is in Cincinnati, who some people define as, quote, the president of the Underground Railroad, which I debate sometimes because there's no one person that organizes the Underground Railroad. It just becomes part of this mythology.
But he was responsible for the escapes of over 3,000 slaves.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
So at least he's the chairman of the board.
Yeah. He's doing his job well.
He was an important person from the dominant society. Okay. Let's just go with that.
Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm happy Levi's there. That's a lot of people rescued.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
Okay, so back to the story, Eric. We still don't have a plan for how 28 black people are going to of all ages are going to walk through a town square in a not necessarily safe place. What's the plan at this point?
The plan is they're going to dress up as a funeral procession.
Whoa, that's some ingenious planning.
And so you have a horse and a buggy, and you have a cover over the buggy that you have a coffin in, and then you have people dressed up in funeral attire.
Wow.
And they're going to parade through the town as it's a funeral.
Wow.
And most people have reverence for a funeral, regardless of race.
Yeah.
And that's just what they do. They literally walk through town as a funeral procession.
Oh, wow.
All at this point, it's 27 of them because the one child had passed. And they literally just walk through town. And nobody says a word. In the middle of the day.
was this always part of their plan? Like from the date, from day dot, was this how they knew they'd get what?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. That was the part of the plan.
Right.
Especially because no one wants to deal with black grief either. Like, you know, we will respect, but like, seriously, when people see it, they don't, they're just like, oh, it's intense, and just look away and run. Right. So that was brilliant. Like, that is literally hiding in plain sight.
Truly
if we just
brilliant.
Do what we do if someone died, and it's not like they had plenty of source material to draw that emotion from. People would just look the other way and try to drive around, avoid it, you know?
It's absolutely, it's actually ingenious. It really is.
Yeah.
If you flip it on its head, it's similar to the story that people try to negate when they talk about the intellectual abilities of people of color in general terms. The whole Cincinnati 28 is similar to the Montgomery bus boycott with Rosa Parks, which is nothing's wrong with a spontaneous event. But it makes it a little more powerful when you say she had been organizing with the local NAACP chapter, and there was two people who did it before her, because it makes it more powerful with the more details you tell.
Let's make it a fluke. Absolutely.
Yeah, that like, yes, it was planning. You had to try and then try again, and you were thwarted, and you still kept coming back. That reinstates quite a bit of humanity in people.
Yes.
Right.
So, okay. They have made it through this ingenious funeral procession through Cincinnati.
Yes.
Now, where do they go? And when they get there, what challenges might be awaiting them as they try to start new lives?
So they end up the north part of the city that's now called North College Hill.
Okay.
And so there's a group of African Americans who live there up in North College Hill, and some progressive whites. Some of them get jobs there. The majority, however, decide, because, again, Ohio doesn't necessarily want people of color, especially fugitives, in the state. They had demonstrated that with the Black Codes, so they're going to continue north. They continue to north part of Ohio, travel to Michigan, and end up in Canada.
But I mean, this is still quite the journey. I mean, if we're going from Cincinnati all the way to Canada, how much more time are we talking about them being on this procession to freedom or safety?
So once they get out of downtown and they shed that procession, what do you want to call it, situation, they're now organizing and looking like, quote, regular folks. But they're still part of the group. They still mostly live in the same areas. They still generally talk to the same people. But they decide after a couple days and a couple weeks that Ohio is not the place to be, because they're still being psychologically, emotionally, and physically could be attacked.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because that when we're talking about what they're escaping from, again, it's not just the violence and it's the terror that Desiree and I were talking about earlier that you really feel so much in the show. And I think that when you get to somewhere like Ohio, where are we safe, are we not, you are still living in that godforsaken constant state of terror. And that, I think, is the thing that you really want to run from and need to have escape from. And I'd keep going north as well till I got rid of that. Yeah. Keep going. Absolutely. That's not freedom, is it?
It's true, but you have to understand at the same time, Canada is not the bastion of equality and justice and freedom either. They're not welcoming in people of color to Canada.
Mm. Yeah.
They just happen to move to Canada and stay in one pocket, and they're still harassed in Canada.
Were they slightly less murdery in Canada, though? that's my perception.
If that's a term, yes.
Like, similar to America, but less murdery.
Yeah, less murdery, less rapey and pillagey.
Yeah, just a little bit.
I guess.
You know, because at some point it's like, well, we're going to hit the North Pole. Like, we're not going there. So we got how terrified versus frozen am I?
It's slightly better than the United States. Slightly. Freedom is defined by the beholder.
So, Eric, did they make it to Canada? Tell me they make it to Canada. And is it on record that they made it there?
Yeah, they made it to Canada. Yeah, yeah. The question is, there's not a lot of records of once they got to Canada, how they were treated.
Mm-hmm.
The speculation is, if you can just follow the mentality of Canadians, not to say that oppression and murder and violence is just defined to one particular country, nation, group of people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it wasn't like they were blended into the Canadian community as equals. There's no way.
Eric, what is it that you love about this story?
I love the group mentality. I love the perseverance. I love the resistance. I love the mindset. I love how people can work to overcome, relatively speaking, the situations they're born into to make progress based on how they define it. And I also love the story that it's different than the norm. It's different than the one or two people. It's different than what people are told about the Underground Railroad, which I argue, as several other historians have argued, that the Underground Railroad is the first civil rights, human rights movement in the history of the United States of America. Because you have African Americans and a segment of progressive whites working to change the trajectory of the United States based on the principles, not on the man, based on the principles of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, endowed by certain rights, among those are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Based on the principles, not on the man, Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah. And also, for this particular story, what I love is just how much less it is about the means of violence involved in escape and more about being really, really ingeniously clever enough to be able to hide in plain sight, and how complacent everybody else got in not looking at that. I mean, obviously, I'm sure they looked at funeral processions a little differently from then on out, but like just how ingenious that was, that pretty much, aside from an unfortunate case of malnutrition and starvation, no one was hurt or injured because they were able to do this so brilliantly.
Yeah. And I love that it just goes straight against the constant narrative of the things that they believed we could do and could achieve and could think like. Mm-hmm. And actually, we didn't even need to let them know what we were up to. It's just like lightning. Don't even see us.
Yeah, exactly. The more invisible we are to you as people, the better it gets for us to do what we have to do in order to be people.
Eric, thank you. It's just an incredible story that I knew absolutely nothing about. And it's just one of those stories you just should know and need to know.
Yes.
Full stop.
Yeah, and that I will tell everyone that I meet about, like, oh, you want to know something real cool. So thank you so much,
Eric.
Thank you for inviting me.
If you haven't watched the Barry Jenkins series, it is poignant and it is powerful, and it is on Amazon Prime Video now. Don't forget to follow or subscribe to the podcast, and we'll be back next week with another story of an audacious escape.